everyone, and welcome back to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today we have a very special guest, a good friend of mine, coming to talk about the technical aspects of making music versus the artistic side. And so today we'll be having a very, very good guest that's mastered some records for us, and we're very lucky to have him. Please help me welcome from the bakery in Culver City, California, on the Sony lot, Mr. Peter Hewitt Dutton.
Hello, Peter. It's Cliff. How are you?
Hey, very well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, man. How's life treating you these days?
It's a strange world at the moment, isn't it? It's a very strange world.
Yeah.
How's quarantine into you?
it hasn't been too bad, all considering. I'm doing pretty well, actually.
Yeah, glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. Been creative?
Yeah, we had a CNN spot. We released some Jam in the Van material that came out last month. We have the new two new vinyls that you worked on coming out digitally in the last 2 months, both the physical copies coming out in July and August. So just kind of excited about that.
They look great.
Bringing it to the world. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always good to see those things because, given what we do, you never kind of see the final product. Yeah, it's quite nice when people send through that kind of thing just to see what it all ends up like.
Yeah, you're like the behind the scenes guy.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's not that uncommon for us to be completely left off credits with that behind the scenes that people forget about us.
but it's nice to be remembered in those times when you can be, for sure.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Like I say, and when you see the final product, something you've worked on, yeah, that's quite fulfilling. It's one of those things that reminds you why you do this shit.
Yes. Well, we made sure that we put your name on it, so it's all.
No,
good.
I saw that. I really appreciate that. Thanks for that, man. Yeah. It's always nice to see that you get the credit, and hopefully someone else sees it and they go, oh, I really like the way that sounded.
Yeah, exactly. And you know your stuff, and you've been doing it a long time. So then my first question for you, I wanted to kind of understand the difference between half beat, vinyl cut, and then whatever traditional mastering is for digital and vinyl. Like, how are those kind of different? I saw like they were all listed differently in your bio. So what's the difference between those?
Half beat cutting is essentially a... It's an extension on how you'd normally cut a record. What we're doing is we're taking it a technical step beyond. So essentially we're cutting a record that people will buy in the shops and it will sound as great, well, hopefully better than a normal record because of the way we're doing it, but it'll play just the same as any other record on their turntable. When we are recording the disc, we spin the disc at half its normal speed and then we play back the audio at half its normal speed as well. What it does is it gives all of the equipment far more time to process what's going on. The groove of a vinyl record is a literal representation of the audio. All we're doing is we're shaking that little stylus that makes the groove, and then that groove shakes your stylus on playback, which makes the sound. So the more information, more detail that we can get into that groove, essentially the more detail we're going to get in the audio out of the other end. So we spend a lot of time cutting the record so that when it comes out of the other end, it's like you get a much better sound reproduction of it. And we generally separate those things because it's quite a rare talent to really be able to do it. There's not that many engineers around the world who do cut at half speed. I know of probably maybe five or six in London, and I believe, unless someone can correct me, we're the only ones in the US who are still cutting at half speed at the moment. So there's not too many people doing it. But we believe the sonic benefits are worth the time that you have to put into it. And in terms of digital mastering, that's getting it to the point in the first place. So we will receive the various mixes from the producer, from the engineer, from the artist, whoever's coordinating the project, bring that together in a cohesive form. Once we've got that album, once we've got a series of songs that work as an album or as an EP or whatever they're supposed to be, then we can worry about how we're getting that onto vinyl.
Okay. And would a layman, like would the normal person be able to hear the difference in cutting it in half speed versus the traditional speed? Or
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the difference, most of the differences are because the vinyl is an analog medium. The differences are don't work the same way the differences would in a digital medium. So what we're doing is we're generally improving the fidelity of the sound. We're getting more detail into the sound. So the biggest positive that you usually get from cutting at half speed, you'll get less distortion, and that's because we're stressing all of the amps that go along the way less. We're stressing all of the electronics less, because they're having to work far less hard at the time. You also generally get a more defined stereo image and a tighter bass sound. And again, those just become because we're able to put more detail into the physical groove that's going onto the record. Everything in the chain has just got more time to do its thing, so we can put a bit more detail in there. And that generally translates through to just more of the feel of the music coming through. What might get lost in electronics or distortion on a regular full-speed cut, we're able to get more of that onto the disc in a half-speed cut.
Got it. That makes sense. So then you've done this type of work for Public Enemy and Led Zeppelin, The Carpenters, Rolling Stones, Slash, and so many other people that you haven't even had time to update on your bio that you
yeah.
About.
Yeah, you reminded me about that the other day. I really need to get around to updating the bio on the website. There's a good few releases on there we need to add.
What's your favorite project that you worked on that you've done?
That is a very difficult question to answer. Each project is different in the way you approach it. Some things are special for you personally. Some things might be a sort of technical or a professional challenge with issues that you might need to work through. I mean, it's kind of predictably, it's probably one of the ones that you mentioned at the beginning there, though. Being able to work on the remastering project for Led Zeppelin was quite a pinch-me kind of moment. There was only probably four engineers working on the entire project, of which, I was one of them, and that's going to go down as one of those memories that stays with you for a long time, getting to hear those tapes in their original form and being able to talk to Jimmy Page about how he recorded this stuff. And Chris Kimsey, the engineer who recorded a lot of it as well, he was involved and got to talk to him about how he recorded it and how he worked with the band. And that's one of those projects that's probably going to be pretty hard to top. And from a personal perspective as well, I was involved in the last remastering of the Oasis catalog as well, which was done just before I left, a few years actually, before I left Metropolis in London. Engineer there called Ian Cooper had been working with Noel Gallagher for a few years. And he was coming to his retirement, and they were deciding that they wanted to issue some remasters of the first three albums that Oasis released. So they needed to get Ian in. And he, knowing that I had been a fan from when I was a teenager, sort of got me involved quite heavily, so going through all of the tapes and trying to find the right takes of things and mastering a few of the tracks as well. That was one of those moments where if you think about when you were a teenager listening to the music and then you've been told that 20 years later you'd been working on it, you probably wouldn't have believed yourself.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand that. The crazy thing is, I heard that, I think it was Warner Brothers, where there was like a huge fire maybe a decade ago.
And Universal.
Universal, yeah. We lost so many.
That was a tragedy.
So what does that do when it comes to mastering? Like when those tapes are gone, even though they exist on records or they exist in digital media, what does that do to mastering and remastering for, like, I mean, basically you just can't ever get the original tapes again.
That's an interesting question because yes and no. Refer to personal experience, the Led Zeppelin project is quite a good example. The time before us that those albums had been remastered was in 1997 by an engineer in New York called George Marino. Now, unfortunately, he didn't have the original source master tapes to do his mastering from. He had a generational copy that had been sent over to the US at the time of production to produce the US final copies. He hadn't got the original source tapes. So when we did Led Zeppelin, we went straight back. We were able to go right back to Jimmy Page's source tapes, which he'd kept in his vault all these years and had hardly ever been played. So you get an instant improvement in the quality of the original master just because of the source material that we've got there. So when those original tapes are destroyed, it can put certain things into a bit of an issue. But the flip side of that is there are other tapes, like the Beatles are probably the best example of this. The Beatles stereo masters that were mixed in the 60s, those tapes now, as evidenced by the last set of CD remasters, have lost an awful lot of their attack, a lot of their detail, because they've just been played so many times over the years that they're probably not actually the best source to go back to now. If you were going to do a Beatles remastering project now, you'd probably want to start scouring the globe for those copies that were done at the time and then played very little, because they're going to be in a better condition than what were the original tapes. So it can be a hit and miss thing. So there's no doubt at all that the Universal fire was an absolute tragedy, and we have almost certainly lost things in there, some of which had probably never been heard by people who weren't in the recording session. But at the same time, there are still going to be sources out there for those old albums, so there will still be ways to restore them. It's probably just going to need a lot more legwork than it did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see a lot of those kinds of restoration projects, especially when you're doing, when they're trying to find projects throughout the world, certain, you know, African countries, very obscure records, where they just go diving for records and clean them up and push them out digitally and on vinyl again.
Yeah, I've worked on a couple of those projects myself as well. There was, in London before I moved out to Los Angeles, there was a project for the British Military Music Archive. And they had all of these discs that have been recorded live to disc in the 1920s and 30s. Some of them sounded absolutely fantastic, but obviously they were all very old and needed a lot of sort of just cleaning up to bring them into the modern era and make them like palatable to a modern audience.
Nice. And then, so how would you say, again, you mentioned about Metropolis, you mentioned about being from the UK. So what is your kind of origin journey story? How did you get into music? How did you get into mastering? You know, how was it growing up in the UK versus America? And then, like, what brought you over here? Like, your career track from Metropolis to Ocean Wave to the Bakery.
Yeah, well, I suppose like anyone who does this for a living, it starts from a love of music. And that love of music came from, again, as I suppose most people in this situation, my parents. My dad used to play me Beatles and Floyd and all that kind of stuff when I was like 4 or 5, that kind of age. I remember wearing through tapes of Dark Side of the Moon that he'd made for me off his records and that kind of thing, just obsessing over them. So it was always that thing of knowing I want to work in music. But I was never much good as an actual musician, if that makes sense. I play a few instruments here and there, but I was never great. I was drawn to the other side, though, that idea of, well, how can you make this sound better? What can you do with this stuff? And how you capture this stuff in the first place? So I used to just do all sorts of sound-related stuff, just recording friends' bands and working on independent films, anything, just trying your hand at all sorts of stuff. And after a few years of doing this, you kind of find the thing that people start paying you to do, and that, for me, became mastering. A few people started repeat sending me work, and then it became obvious that that was therefore what I was particularly good at within the field of sound. You can be a general sound engineer, but all of the people working at the top end of the industry are very specialists to a certain area of what they do. So when you find that area, pursue it. And at the time when I realized that mastering was the thing for me, I was already working as a night receptionist at Metropolis in West London. For those who don't know, it's a large studio complex. They were built in the late 80s. They've got 4 recoding studios. I think it's 6 mastering rooms now. It's a fantastic place, full of some incredibly talented people. But their mastering department particularly is legendary. So when I realized that mastering was what I was kind of getting good at, I started to pursue the mastering engineers at Metropolis, likes of Tim Young and Tony Cousins, Ian Cooper, Stuart Hawkes. These are like engineers who've been around for decades doing this stuff, and just start listening to them, just start absorbing what they're doing. Eventually, they started to take me into the mastering department and started to move through the ranks, as it were. I'd known for a long time that I wanted to ultimately probably work in Los Angeles. When I was in college, I was very fortunate to do my an internship at what was then Ocean Way, now United on Sunset in Hollywood. And I fell in love with Los Angeles there and then. I was working there for 3 months, and I knew immediately that this was ultimately where I wanted to be. Unfortunately, it's not that easy to move to this country, so you kind of have to have a very good reason to. So I had to go home and make something of a name for myself in the UK before I could get out here. And then on one of several trips out here, I bumped into Eric Boulanger, and we hit it off pretty quickly, and he brought me on board at the bakery, and it's been fantastic. It's been the best decision I ever made.
Wow. And so who would say was your biggest mentor, or who really took you under their wing and kind of showed you the ropes?
That's impossible to say. I was incredibly fortunate being at Metropolis. Most mastering houses around the world, even including the bakery, you have a group of very few engineers. At the bakery, we have three, which even for a small company like us is quite a few. At Metropolis, when I joined, there were 9. So there were an awful lot of people there to be able to draw from. Even at that point, at least 6 or 7 of them had been in the industry 30, 40 years by then. There were credits ranging from Bowie to the Sex Pistols to Zeppelin to like modern dancer Ed Sheeran and Lana Del Rey and people like that. All of that kind of stuff was happening at Metropolis from the various engineers that were there. So I was very fortunate that I could draw different things from different engineers. And I think if any of them individually looked at the way I work, they'd question it and tell me I'm completely wrong. But I've taken what I like from each of them and sort of formed my own way of working from that. And I suppose that's probably how most engineers have done it as well. But I was just very fortunate to have a really big pool of incredibly talented engineers to learn from at that time.
That's interesting. That's interesting. And then it's kind of like helped you become who you've become. So then, you know, you worked with like really known groups, but also some lesser known groups. Are there any lesser known groups that you've worked with that you think people should listen to or should know about?
Oh, man, that's the kind of question you need prepping for before you get asked. Without question. And there's been numerous times when you find yourself working on a track and you just look down and your foot tapping and you don't realize that it was doing that. And that's when you realize that you're clearly working on something that you actually enjoy as well. But off the top of my head, I wouldn't like to answer that for fear of missing someone out.
Of course. Well, I will say just randomly, when I was talking with James about doing this interview with you and I looked through your bio, I saw that I had literally on Spotify stumbled upon a track by an artist named Rumor doing a Hal David Burr Bacharach songbook that you had mastered. And it just randomly happened exactly the same day.
No, I didn't master that. I can't take full credit for that one. That was mastered by Tony Cousins, who was one of what we referred to as the godfathers at Metropolis, one of the guys who'd been doing it for, I think he started mastering in the late 70s, so yeah, before I was born. But he decided to stop cutting records when an awful lot of engineers did in the kind of late 90s when it dropped off. And then when the surge came back again for vinyl to start happening, he never really got that interested in doing it again. So I became fortunate enough to then take up his cutting work. So, yeah, it meant I got to work on quite a few really good projects off the back of an engineer like Tony. It was a great one to work on, though, because when it came to vinyl, they weren't entirely sure how they wanted to do it. And we described to them the half-speed process that we were working on at the time and did them a few test cuts, played them both ways of the sort of normal cut and how it would sound at half-speed. And they were blown away by the half-speed and were insistent that it had to be done that way immediately.
So then as we talk about the resurgence, how do you feel such an old medium as vinyl kind of fits into our digital world? Vinyl has surpassed CD sales, obviously, in this last couple of years, you know, and a lot of people are using Spotify and Apple Music and things like that. But still, vinyl has a very special place. And, you know, where do you feel that fits in now?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because you always have to question who's actually buying vinyl. I think a lot of vinyl these days is bought by people who probably never play it, maybe not even have a record player. But if they are, if that increase in sales is enabling us to cut more vinyl for the people who really do want to listen to it, then I think that's a good thing. Vinyl's more about the experience, and that ties more into music. If you Spotify like treat music in a very disposable way. It's great if you, I don't know, there's a song in your head and you just want to hear it, and you can press three buttons and suddenly it's playing. That's amazing. But the idea of the sort of endless shuffle modes and tracks that go on forever that no one's really paying attention to, it starts to treat music in a very disposable way. Whereas vinyl, it's more about the experience. You're going to sit down, you're going to put the record on, you're going to listen to it. When it comes to the end of the vinyl, you've got to get up and turn it over. And you're investing more in listening to the music. Therefore, I think that's where people get more from it.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see that and agree. It definitely is two different experiences. Even sonically, it just has a different sound and feeling.
Yeah, I mean, vinyl is, because it's a physical medium, is very constrained in what you can do with it. I mean, a CD can reproduce some absolutely insane sounds, which you would never be able to put on a vinyl record. But I think what you can put on vinyl record is far more sympathetic to what the human ear hears. So I think that's why, again, it sounds more enjoyable because it's more tailored to, I think, how your ear is hearing things naturally.
That would make sense, especially in a very analog universe. And so is there anyone that you haven't worked for that you would like to work for, master their records or something like that?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, I mean, any of your heroes. I mean, where do you start? I'd love to do some work on some Floyd stuff. I came pretty close once. I was in a shootout to cut the Dave Gilmour Live at Pompeii album, which unfortunately someone else won. Yeah, I'd love to work on some Floyd. I'd love to work with Oasis and the Gallaghers again, that kind of thing. But generally, I don't think so. You can't specify too much because, again, it's one of the joys of mastering is that you work on so much music because whereas a mix engineer might be working on an album for 3 months or something, as a mastering engineer, we're probably only going to be working on that for a few days. So we get so much music coming through that you never know when you're going to hear the next great thing, and you certainly don't know who it's going to come from.
Yeah, and it seems like you have a pretty open mind. You just kind of set the record.
Everyone wants to work with their heroes. And yeah, there's always certain people that you say, oh, I would love to cut a record for this person, or I'd love to master this guy's album. But yeah, ultimately, I just love to hear whatever the next thing that comes through the door is, because the next thing that comes through the door might go on to be my new favorite album.
That's true. Did you ever have any other musical aspirations besides mastering?
Well, like I say, when I first got into it, I just tried everything. I just knew I wanted to work with music. That kind of got broadened at a few points into sound, and I did work on a few independent films doing kind of sound mixing and that kind of thing on those. But ultimately, I always knew I wanted to work on music. So it was more a case of finding that thing that I'm particularly good at. Everyone can do most things, but then you find that one thing that you particularly are good at, be it tracking, mixing, producing, mastering, whatever it is, you'll just come across that thing where suddenly everything feels right. And for me, that was just mastering. And it's not to say I didn't enjoy other things. I used to really enjoy working in the studio with bands and mixing as well. That could be really good fun because you'd be so creative in the mix process. But ultimately, mastering is A, where I felt most comfortable, and B, where, as I say, people were prepared to pay me the most to do it. When you find people are paying you for something, then clearly that's the thing you're good at.
That's true, yeah. There's a serendipity in that. And so if someone was kind of starting out, wanting to do what you did, learning from other engineers and finding their path, like, what advice would you give someone that was starting out wanting to become an engineer, specifically in mastering?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the best thing you can do is to learn from the people who have been doing it the longest. I mean, even now, you wouldn't be able to follow the path I did. And there were other engineers at Metropolis who'd been there from the first days and are now very well established engineers. Again, that got an education I would never be able to get because people are moving on. So I think ultimately it's one of those things in the music industry which is really important but is getting a little bit lost at the moment, is that idea of just listening to the people who have done this before, listening to the people who mastered the records or mixed the records or whatever it is that you want to get into that you like. How did they do it? Why did they do it? What did they use and all this kind of thing. And more often than not, it's going to come down to a case of you just need to spend as much time as you can listening to these people and absorbing the information that they've got to give you and then interpreting it your own way, building your own style out of all of this information that you're getting. And I know that's not an easy thing to do. I was very fortunate to get into Metropolis when I did and be able to follow through into that mastering department and get that education. Unfortunately, it comes down to perseverance. And, you've just got to keep trying and trying until someone lets you in and go on offer to make the tea and sit in the corner and be nice and quiet and just watch what they're doing, that kind of thing, and just absorb as much information as you can. Well, I think before I was regularly paid to go into a studio, I always used to make it my mission that if I was ever going into a studio, that I had to come out having learned something. Anything, just pick something up, the tiniest little thing. And if I, with that attitude, it kind of just meant that I kind of just kept building up more and more little things here and there, and then eventually that leads to, like I say, people starting to pay you to do it.
Yeah, that sounds like a natural, organic kind of process and progression. So then for my final question, what do you want to be most remembered for, or what do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, wow. I've never been asked a question like that before. I don't know, to be honest. I suppose ultimately it's just that thing of like anyone, you just want to be remembered when you're gone, maybe. Have something there that you produced that is there beyond your years, I suppose. Just something that outlives me, and vinyl records certainly do that. I mean, there are probably at this point millions of vinyl records around the world with my signature in the run-out groove that will outlive me by a long time. I suppose that's quite a reassuring thing to know.
Yeah, maybe it'll be in a time capsule for aliens to find.
You never know.
And they'll be like, what an archaic medium. We've light years beyond us.
It still blows my mind, the idea that there's the golden record on the Voyager probes that went out, that we thought the best way to communicate with aliens in the 70s was literally to put a record on the side of the space probe and send it out into space and hope they could play it.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope they can.
I really hope that one day I would love the idea that someone picks that record up and can actually play it. But the idea, it seems quite a complex process, the idea of being able to play a record and not knowing what the medium is in the first place. So I don't know, but yeah, who knows?
Well, hopefully somehow we'll be able to figure that out. I don't know. I don't know if we'll still be around or in many generations to come, but maybe we'll find out together.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, those records, you can actually buy them now. They were recut a few years ago. Someone recut the records that were thrown out on those Voyager probes, and you can buy in the box set now.
Wow, that's interesting. I'll have to check that out.
It's a really cool little set.
I've also heard that people can, like, cut a portion of a tree and, like, run it against the grooves, and it plays some type of sound. I haven't heard it, but I've heard that.
Kind of, yeah. Well, again, this goes back to the idea that a vinyl record is a literal analog of the audio. The groove is just the audio. There is no real decoding process. You've just got to know what it is. Hence the idea of, I wonder whether the aliens will be able to play it or not. But, yes, you get a banknote from certain countries. In the UK, especially now, over the last decade or so, they've started to move the banknotes away from this kind of cotton paper thing to plastic banknotes that you can put in the washing machine and they don't disintegrate. But if you hold one of those really rigid and point one corner into a spinning record and hold it, you'll hear the music coming off the note because it's vibrating according to the groove of the record. So that vibration is then creating the sound in the air that you hear.
Wow, interesting. That's fascinating.
So, yeah, you can play a record with almost anything. You not going to do it much good by playing it with these things, but yeah, you can play a record with almost anything that is just going to sit, sort of sit in there and vibrate, and that's all it needs to do, because once it's vibrating, it shakes the air, and the air creates, that's what creates the sound that you hear.
Well, I mean, just such a storied legacy, and such great to work for, and such great people to work for, and just a great medium that, you know, for over the last, I don't know, 80 years or however long it's been, just people still enjoy it, and it lives on way past.
Oh, the fundamentals are well over 100 years old now. I mean, the basics of what a record is hasn't changed since Edison invented it. It's a groove which is cut according to the vibrations that the stylus picks up in the air. That's all we're doing now that's different from that, basically, is that instead of the having to make the noise in the air then vibrates the stylus, you know, how they used to do it down a big tube to make it as loud as it could when it hit it. Now we just have two little speakers either side of the stylus, which shakes the stylus. So all we're doing is literally playing music into these two tiny speakers. Those speakers shake the stylus. The stylus is dipped in a moving lacquer at the time, and that creates your groove. So all you need to do to play it back is spin that lacquer at the same speed and put something in the groove, which will respond to those shape of the groove.
Well, it's amazing that technology has basically revolutionized. Before, we weren't able to record in the same way, just written music, but actually recorded sound over the last 100 years. That's great that it still lives on in that medium, and technology has improved to kind of keep it going. So,
well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly.
All we've done is sort of incrementally improve how we do it, and that goes on to this day. The lathe that we have at the bakery has been fitted with various things that when it rolled out of the factory didn't exist. We can control a lot of the lathe functions by MIDI from Pro Tools, and the lathe talks both ways to Pro Tools and that kind of thing. Obviously, when the lathe rolled out of the factory in the late 70s, that was just completely impossible. So all we've done is just incrementally improve it as new technology has become available. And that just, yeah, that goes all the way back to Edison.
Well, I hope that you continue to progress over the next 30, 40 plus years, become one of those old people that people seek out, Master Yoda of mastering.
one can only hope.
Until the aliens come and take your records with you to play.
Oh, please.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, for taking the time to talk with us today. Obviously,
you're most welcome.
We'll come back to you once it's out so you can hear it, and look forward to talking to you again, and hopefully when everything settles down, meeting up with you guys again soon.
Yeah, can't wait to see you guys again down the studio.
Sounds good, man. Well, you take care. We'll be talking soon.
Yeah, and you. Keep safe.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening once again to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I would like to thank our special guest, Mr. Peter Hewitt Dutton, live from the bakery, talking about mastering such great vinyl records. I would also like to thank our engineer, Tim Hall, and 1192 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves. Until then, keep it rocking. Take care. We'll talk soon.